Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we will be talking about Insuriated, which arrives in cinema screens and on demand this Friday. And we've also got an interview with the director of Insuriated, Philippe Van Loo. I'm Jake Cunningham, and with me, making a return, is Sam Howlett.
Yeah, I feel like Cooper, I've just emerged from Dougie Jones, finally, yeah. If that happens.
Yeah.
That may not happen.
Yeah, that definitely may.
I mean, I'm not even sure if it did happen, if I'm being honest, so.
So it's good to have you back. What have you been up
to? Thank you. I've been finishing my dissertation, Jake, and having a really fun time doing it.
Yes, many words.
Many, many words. Many long hours. Started again a couple of times. Recommend it to everyone. If you've got any free time in your hands, just write 15,000 words.
Yeah.
On something that you're vaguely confident with.
Yeah, just vaguely confident.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
Like, a glimmer
of confidence. Struggling writers out there, just think, I think I know what I'm talking about.
And then just do it.
Yeah.
Until you've reached the word count and then stop. Mid-word.
Wait, so where does that start? So is your word count 14,000?
If your word count is 14,999 and you're like halfway through the word and it's just A-N, you've got to stop.
So you're saying that the last word of your dissertation is just and?
Yeah. Yes. What's wrong with that?
It sounds good. I look forward to reading it. Right, so what have you been watching?
So this dissertation took over my relaxing watching life. So I've only been watching stuff I needed to watch for the past few months.
Yes, because I texted you stuff like Rubber Glove Jimmy.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't know what that means. So I finished the end of last week, and I've had like 5 days. Okay, I'm going to finish Twin Peaks. And on Monday, I watched, I think, 5 episodes. So I'm using my time well these days. I watched 5 episodes and finished Twin Peaks: The Return.
Well.
There was 18 episodes. It started and then it finished. That's all we can really say about Twin Peaks, I think.
Yeah. I have begun thinking of it as, not to give spoilers.
Yeah, we'll avoid. Really. We can just talk about it in broad strokes.
Yeah,
I think.
But I think of it as episodes 1 to 17 are a 17-hour-long film.
Yeah,
and 18 is that film's epilogue.
Okay, because you kind of get two conclusions, really, don't you?
Yeah,
you get episode 17, which wraps things up. Perhaps more neatly than I even expected.
But because it's the penultimate episode, it feels... You instantly know it feels a bit off.
It feels wrong. Something's wrong. Yeah. And it wraps up quite quickly in a way. Yeah. Considering that a lot of plot points have been dragged on.
Considering it's been 17 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. But for then to wrap everything up in the way it did, it felt quite quick. And then you have, this kind of epilogue, which seems to me almost like the start of a new...
Yeah,
thing.
It almost feels like episode 1 of season 4.
Yeah, which probably will never happen, but...
Yeah. I was talking to someone about this, and we were saying, with the critical and fan reception it's received, you'd hope that Lynch would think, oh, right, I'll do 4. But obviously, we're not David Lynch. So when
he doesn't think like a normal human being, so he's not going to think that way at all.
So when everyone suddenly tells you to do something, what does David Lynch do?
Not do that.
Exactly.
Well, I know a position of director for Star Wars Episode 9 has just opened up, so I'm sure he'll do that.
Yeah, I understand David Lynch loves porgs.
Backwards talking porgs. Yeah. So I really liked it, I think, actually, Twin Peaks The Return, because I think a lot of people would be apprehensive going into it. But I think it did something that we didn't expect it to do, which do something new.
Yeah.
Really new.
Yeah, I think when you, like, it really, in a way, like, it's a shame to lose the real soap opera-ness of the original series. But this, like, when you, like, post Lost Highway, when you look at what Lynch has been making.
He's given up on narrative.
Yeah, this is not dream,
isn't interesting
dream
him
narrative,
anymore, yeah.
isn't it? And this very much feels like a creation of his, for the director he is now.
Yeah.
And I think that's what ultimately we'd rather see, as Twin Peaks was a creation of his at that time.
Exactly. And I think there is enough sort of sentimentality in it to please people that loved the narrative of the old Twin Peaks. I think there's just about enough of it there.
Well, and he manages to really, I think, the thing that annoyed people for a few episodes at the start that now is almost universally loved is Dougie Jones.
Yeah.
And Dougie Jones has his own story. And that's, and people are really going to cherish that. And that's got the melodrama and the romance that was, for me, maybe missing from a few episodes, because that was something that I loved.
I think it missed heart occasionally. Yeah. And there are times when it has that, which almost make you miss it even more. Mm. You think, why isn't the rest of it like this? But then you think, no, we shouldn't be given what we want.
Yeah.
And the last episode just really doesn't give you what you want in any way, shape or form, apart from setting it up so that it could continue in a few years, perhaps.
And then actually that feels right, because season one ended like that. Season two ended like that.
Yeah. It would be weird if it was all closed off. You'd almost feel empty, I think, than if it hadn't. So.
Yeah, it's always nicer to live in a world where there's the potential of more Twin Peaks.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, it came and it was the best TV show of the year, probably.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
So well worth the hype in the end. What have you been watching, Jake?
Well, right on time, I watched Christopher Nolan's new film.
Speaking of current hype.
Yeah, I watched Dunkirk. And I've been saying for weeks and weeks, like, oh no, I'm gonna go IMAX. I'm gonna do it justice. I'm gonna do it how it was meant to be seen.
Yeah.
But then it ultimately reached a point where I thought, well, shouldn't this be good regardless of how I watch it anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw it just in a regular screen, regular sound, nothing special with location wise in that respect, and I thought it was good. I wanted to like it more. I can say that I really appreciate it.
Okay.
And that it's a five-star piece of filmmaking. Like the craft that is on show is excellent and everyone's doing a great job. And it was just like, you can see everyone's doing well, but it just lacked for me a little bit more character emotion.
Okay.
There was the narrative was there.
Yeah.
And I liked how it was put together and the three timelines really worked for me. But it didn't, the thing that I think the three timeline thing also stopped it from having was a gateway character. I think that's meant to be Fionn, what's his surname?
I don't know.
No.
But he's the one you kind of think of as the main character, right?
Yeah,
he's the guy on the beach. He's on all the posters. He's pretty much at the front of the film.
Yeah.
And he's a bit of a sort of DiCaprio in The Revenant, where he's kind of this character that you can possess.
Yeah.
He is your eyes and ears on the ground, literally.
But then with The Revenant, you're with him the whole time.
Right. So
and you're dropped
separates.
Right into the action.
Yeah.
And weirdly, my favorite person in the whole thing is Tom Hardy. I think he's the best thing in it.
Yeah.
Because I think he's got the biggest challenge and he completely overcomes it.
Well, that man can act with his eyes.
Yeah. And I think some people were annoyed with there is a shot near the end of the film where he shows his face. Yeah. And I actually felt like he earned it.
Yeah. I loved it, but maybe it's because I saw it when it was... I didn't have enough as much build-up as you have. Maybe that's part of it, but... I think I'd still like it if I had only seen it when you saw it. Like.
Yeah, I think maybe if I had got swept up in the hype at the time, like yeah. when it was it 6 weeks ago?
Yeah, something
and,
like that.
And everything was Dunkirk.
Yeah.
I'm saying this is a 4-star film, and I think it's really good. And like this is what cinema should be.
Yeah.
That you this does really work as a big screen experience. But that also raises the debate about whether that's what it should be. Like, right. should you be making something that is really at its best in that environment? And I'd be curious to see what it looks like if you watch it on an iPhone.
Yeah, or like on at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the three timelines is, it's clever.
It's very Nolan.
It's very Nolan, but then it's not annoying Nolan.
No.
It's not like, I'm a genius. Yeah. It's not like that. I didn't find it distracting. No. And I know people that loved the film. And just didn't get the timeline thing. They just didn't work it out. But they didn't impede how they saw the film.
Oh, I really liked it, and it's because that's the I love those puzzle pieces that come with his films. And when you do piece like so, when you see from the boat perspective that they notice a plane's going down, and you realize 15 minutes ago you saw the other side of that conversation from the plane. I really liked that, and that I think that helps with kind of that. Broken, fractured perspective that comes with the memories of war that you don't remember a war as we woke up in the morning, we left for war.
Yeah,
it is this fractured thing, and I think that's part.
And
of
you're
what
it's not. Going I don't. I think the thing about the emotional character is that in war you're not thinking about how you're feeling. You just need to just do what needs to be done, and you're not thinking I'm scared, I'm this, I'm that. You just need to do things to get done to survive.
Yeah, and there is that aspect of putting on a brave face, but I don't, like, there was no one here who I could feel was for me an opening into an emotional connection.
Okay. I think, weirdly, the most emotional heavy lifting was Harry Styles.
Yeah, I think he's perhaps the most complex in the last moments of the film.
Yeah, which is, and I think that could, reading out that speech... could have been done really badly and could have been really on the nose, really ham-fisted, but I think it's done really well, and it's done just at the right moment, and I did cry.
That's interesting to say, because I really didn't get along with the last few minutes of the film.
Because I could see it being, overtly, sort of hideously patriotic in a way, at a time when we don't necessarily want to be patriotic. Yeah. But
for me, it was too far.
See, I felt it earned that. Right. I thought that it wasn't being, it was more... It felt sincere. It didn't feel forced.
Mm.
But
that's weird because, again, for me, it was the aspect of it feeling forced that it was shoehorned in. And I kind of, there's a bit where we see Mark Rylance's character kind of just go into a crowd. He just, he just says bye and then goes into a crowd. And it's a really short cut and it doesn't linger on him or anything.
Yeah.
And I thought that should have been it. That it's just
all the characters should have just been disappeared.
You just go. Yeah. And I think that would have actually had more impact for me because then it makes you think this was so many people.
Yeah.
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 But there we are. That is Dunkirk and Twin Peaks. Which obviously...
Well, join us next week.
But talking of people, I suppose, putting on a brave face amongst a war zone, we must talk about Insuriated, which is Philippe Van Loo's new film. It premiered at Berlin Film Festival in 2017, this year, so 9 months ago now.
February, I think, wasn't it? Yeah. Berlin.
And it won the Panorama Audience Award, and I think we had already discussed it on this very podcast.
We have. You can go check out our archive on iTunes and SoundCloud, and it will be the Berlin Festival Review Roundup show, where Kate and Damo discussed it. They both liked it.
Yeah. And this is sort of like has a link to Dunkirk there, in that these are tough films to say that you like.
Yeah, because they're so kind of, is harrowing the word? They're kind of, they're tough.
Mm.
It's weird. You'd be.
You admire them.
You admire them. It's hard to think, oh, I really enjoyed that. Yeah. I really liked that.
Mm.
I think as well, it's interesting that Because I was thinking, when I was thinking about things to talk about with Insuriated, I was thinking, oh, it's a war. It's an interesting take on the war film. I sort of thought, oh, is it a war film? Should we call it a war film when compared with Dunkirk? Dunkirk is a war film, I think.
Well, Van Loo says about Insuriated, which we'll talk about it plot-wise, he calls it a film about war.
Okay.
Not necessarily a war film. And why do you think that is?
Well, we don't see a single soldier, primarily. We don't see any war actually take place. It all takes place in this one apartment. The war, it revolves around the situation in the apartment, but doesn't necessarily... Obviously, it impacts it, but the film, yeah, there's no war in the film, per se.
Yeah. So there is a family who perhaps have also taken in another family as a safe space, in inverted commas, how safe it is, in an apartment building in Damascus. And there is a lot of violence going on outside and destruction. And for anyone listening that would, I just want a warning there. So we will talk about a lot of violence and war and sexual assault in this episode. So if you would rather stop listening, go ahead. That's absolutely fine. And so we begin the film with these three. There are three shots. One of an older man who's smoking and looking out a window, who sits down in a chair and the camera shows his really nice library of books. Mm-hmm. And then we see another character go over to a water tank and then fill up a glass and splash her face. And then we see some kids as well. And going into the film, as I try to do with the podcast ones, go into it with as little information as I can. I thought, oh, this is we get a few different perspectives of the Syrian war from a few different locations and characters. And then the following shot after these three introductory ones is a tracking shot that goes through the house, and you realize that this is all the same group of people.
Yeah, you realize this is the film, that we're not really going to be leaving these people or this space. And it's a really nice introduction. So it kind of pulls the rug from under you about what you expect you're going to watch.
Yeah, definitely. And so we have this other family who are with a newborn who are also staying in the family home. And so we have a lot of people here. We have the two leads are Yazan, played by Hiyam Abbas, and a character known as Halima, played by Diaman Bu Aboud. And these are the kind of two lead women in the film. But then we also have some of the relationships aren't actually entirely clear.
Not clear at all. No. Especially there was one character in particular who we'll talk about that I still can't quite work out his place in the family.
Because there are two young women, an adolescent boy, a very young boy, a grandfather, the husband of Halima, their newborn.
Yeah.
And it's all moving around this apartment all at once. And I suppose the plot really begins when Halima's husband leaves the apartment building because he has arranged some kind of escape.
Yeah.
And so leaves to then bring back someone to help them get out. And I suppose that's where it begins, because he leaves and there is a sniper out there and he is shot down in the car park.
Yeah. And then, that's the incident that kicks everything off. And that happens really early on, and it's actually quite... Oh, God, this is... I thought the whole film was going to be that. There's going to be a lot of... I thought the sniper was going to... It was going to be almost a sort of action thriller in a way about they have to leave while it's a sniper.
Yeah.
But I'm glad it didn't go down that route.
And it's quite nice because you feel like with these films, that's a looming threat.
Yeah.
That's always going to be there. And so it's nice that that happens very quickly.
Yeah.
To leave you with the characters for 80 minutes.
Yeah.
And to actually really get into the dynamics of this family and their relationships. And so one of the characters sees this sniper attack. After disclosing it to Yazan, they decide to hide that information from Halima, the chap who's been shot's wife. And so going on from there, we end up just in this house as this kind of secret burns away. And then at another point, people break into the house as well. And yeah, I suppose that's... It's there's not a huge amount of story here.
No, I think that's enough you need to know really going in. Okay, so as promised, I sat down with the film's writer and director, Philippe Van Loo, to discuss the ins and outs of the film. Enjoy. All right, and we're delighted to be joined on the Curzon podcast by Philippe Van Loo. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're talking about Insyriated. The film is set against the backdrop of the Syrian war, which we know is very real. But the people at the centre of your film, the family in the apartment, I'm wondering how real are they? Are they based on some sort of reality or are they completely fictional?
Well, for me, they're completely fictional because, right. Of course, I created these people. But then I believe that they're just about... everywhere and in every war at the same time. What was given to me was an anecdote by a friend of mine who's a director of photography, and she's a Syrian director of photography. And in 2012, so the war had been raging already for a little bit over a year, and it had been a year and a half that they had been like sliding progressively into it. And so in December 2012, she was in Paris, and so I asked her about her family in Syria, and she told me that they didn't have any news from her father that was trapped inside his apartment in Aleppo. And it had been 3 weeks, and they hardly knew anything about what was going on for him. So that was really a key for me, because from the beginning, in the very early stages of the demonstrations in the spring of 2011, when people were shot at by snipers from the roofs of the buildings, I realized that this would probably soar into something really dramatic. And I wanted to do something, but then I was helpless. I had I just didn't know how to go about it. And so finally, this anecdote that she gave me just like gave me a key, and so that was the one key that I used. Just figuring this man inside his apartment gave me the idea of like placing other people in there, and mostly women, because I believe that in times of war it's mostly women that are left behind. Men are generally away, in a sense.
Okay. And your previous film as a director, The Day God Walked Away, it also shares with Insyriated this idea of looking at a conflict, but not from the point of view of a soldier, from the point of view of a civilian women. Can you talk about why you feel like exploring national crisis in this way, rather than through the soldiers, but looking at sort of the people who it affects rather than the effectors in that way?
Because... heroes don't really interest me, that's one. But I'm very interested in ordinary people.
Right.
Because I belong to them. I'm myself an ordinary person.
Yeah.
And what would I do if I was placed in a situation like that? That's one. Then the other thing is that I believe that when we're facing a situation like this, and we're not a fighter, we're not armed, we don't know how to cope... We find ourselves making decisions that eventually are that are the result of our... I mean, that are guided by our instinct mostly, and not our reason. I mean, would we, if we start reasoning in some of these situations, we are dead.
Right. Okay.
And so, the instinct of survival takes over. Your body takes over. At some point, which leaves you with these very irreconcilable situations sometimes, where you find yourself guilty of having done what you just did, but then was there any other way of acting? So that's at the center of this film. I think it was at the center of the other film as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's been a preoccupation of mine, I must say. I realized that.
Yeah. And I mean, I've seen the film being described as a war film, but there isn't any actual war per se in the film. I mean, what do you think of it being called as a war film?
It's not a war film. It's a film about war.
Okay.
And that's, I mean, to me, that makes a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the war is there. It's everywhere. It's all around them. and we see how they cope. We see how, I mean, they try to remain standing, in a sense, with difficulty, no water, with no electricity, telephone that's erratic and stuff, and yet trying to organize themselves to sort of keep a sense of normality, which I believe is the only way out.
Okay.
If you don't try to be domestically routine, in this kind of situation, and you let yourself drift into something that is abnormal, then you become crazy.
Yeah, and you have that in the film a lot. Like, they're constantly cleaning and dusting. Absolutely. And cooking, and the kids are playing, and there's a really nice relationship between the grandson and the grandfather. But he kind of, when he kind of pricks him, and there's that.
And for instance, about the little boy, I mean, isn't it extraordinary how he copes with it?
Yeah.
In a sense, because he's a young boy, and he can just like switch off the anxiety at points, because he needs that. And it's a question of, it's also a question of body language, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. It's like seeing, you know, war through the eyes of a child.
Yes.
You have to, they turn it on and off. They don't react the same way we might, for example. Yeah. And in your previous film, The Day God Walked Away, you look at the Rwandan genocide several years after it happened, but the Syrian war is still ongoing. I mean, does that affect how you wrote and then made the film? And do you think that will affect how people watch the film? The fact that it's something, it's not like when we watch a World War II film, we know how it ends, we know that it does end, whereas this is still going on, seemingly infinitely. I mean, what do you think about that?
You're right. I'll tell you two things.
Okay.
The first one is that it took me 10 years before I imagined that it was a possibility for me to write about the genocide in Rwanda, which had been really a shock.
Yeah.
To me and to many people, I guess. And so from then on, I decided that this was the one film that I really wanted to make, and I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This situation occurred in Syria. I was in the same state of shock, in a sense. And I just didn't want to let 10 years go again, go by again. And so I wanted to act as quickly as possible. I wished that the film had been out 3 years ago.
Mm.
Unfortunately, it takes time to be financed and all that. And so we have to fabricate it, in a sense. So, and you're right. The situation is ongoing, and unfortunately, we don't hear so much about it anymore.
No.
And I think we pretty much abandoned these people at this point. And so it is difficult, for instance, when the film is acclaimed, when we get praised for it, when we receive an award eventually.
Yes.
It is difficult to just rejoice at that and not think that eventually it's... there are people in great suffering. But then I realize also, that's the second thing I wanted to say, I realize also that what was totally unexpected for me was that we got audience awards.
Yeah, congratulations, by the way.
Yes, and the first one was in Berlin, then we had another one in Malta, and then we had a third one in France just a couple of weeks ago. with different publics,
yeah,
different audiences. And what it tells me is that there is a sympathy for the Syrian people and for the Syrian refugees. And I think that eventually what, I mean, the audience coming to see the film is sensitive to that situation in a way that is kind of new, because the film offers them another level of understanding, or a different emotion. I'd say more like this. Something that is really emotional.
And yeah.
So they, all these people that have sought refuge in our countries in Europe for the last 3 years, we've seen them coming by waves, and not really knowing. We know that there is war in Syria, and that they're fleeing Syria, their country. But then we don't have any real sense of the reality that made them decide and that pushed them outside their country. And maybe the film helps, in a sense, bringing some images into that.
Yeah, some awareness.
Some awareness. Yeah.
And I can't help but notice that you've walked in here with a Fire at Sea DVD. And I mean, these are both films that are, you know, like you say, they're bringing something important to an audience's attention that they may have drifted past them. Do you think film has kind of a responsibility as an art film to kind of show these things to people, to not just be entertainment?
No, I wouldn't say that we have a responsibility, or our films have a responsibility. I think that we have a response. I mean, I don't know. It's not a question of responsibility. It's a question of humanity.
Okay.
I believe that authors, cinema is most generally seeking humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wouldn't know what to do with a film that would pretend to be an author's film, and that would be fascist, for instance.
Yeah.
That would be strange, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. So I wanted to talk a bit about the filmmaking process. So something that really struck me, and has struck a lot of people, is the use of sound in the film. Because, as I mentioned, we don't really see any specific war going on, but we know it's there all the time because of the sound around them. Could you talk about the sound design of the film and whether the actors could hear the sound of the bullets and the explosions, or if they were added in post-production?
No, everything was added in post-production.
Okay.
And then for the major sound events, were like an explosion or something like that, we had like a cue with an element of sound that was played.
Sure. Okay.
But it was like puke in terms of
right.
realism. But but then the good thing, or the sad thing, is that all the actors in the film have first-hand experience.
Wow. Okay.
Of the situation of war. I mean, Hiam Abbas, she grew up in the north of Israel, and she had rockets flying over her head. And Diamant Bouabouch, she's Lebanese from Beirut, she grew up in the war as well. And all the others are Syrian, and most of them are refugees, and so they've been refugees living in Lebanon, and so they've been exposed to that themselves, the kids, essentially.
Yeah.
And so everyone knew, and also, and that was a help to me, because I am the one that's completely candid about this.
Okay.
I have never been in a situation of war in my life. And so the sound design was completely fabricated, but then at the same time, again, with the help of my image editor, Gladys Juju, who is also Lebanese and who also grew up with the war around her neighborhood. So she could tell me where this was realistic and authentic and where it wasn't.
Right,
and eventually she would have placed a lot more because when it really happens, it's a lot more than what we hear in the film,
okay.
In a sense.
So you had to hold back a little bit.
We had to hold back because otherwise it gets inaudible and I mean, you lose touch with the sense. I mean, reality in the cinema is kind of difficult because it's authenticity.
Yeah.
And finally, it's something that is, it's tricky in a sense. But then there is another thing, another aspect to that, which is that, as in the first film, I tend to use sound much more than image to convey these things, because I believe that sound has something that is really much more immediate on our senses. And so subconsciously, we hear sound. We don't have to read it. We don't have to decode it. It's just instantaneous, and it goes really to the stomach right away.
Yeah,
and so that's really important to me, because that's what I'm trying to work on. And I don't have, and I don't think I would like that, to have the means of fabricating a situation visually, that would be a situation of war. It's not, I don't find that so interesting in a sense.
No, okay.
I find it much more interesting to, actually what is, and it happens also in the rape scene, when we are in the kitchen
that have sought
refuge in the kitchen while this young woman, Halima, is left alone facing the aggressors, I find that it is more painful for the audience to listen when we're in the kitchen than watching her being beaten by those two guys.
Yeah.
And the reason is for that also, that we have the faces of the other protagonists in the film, the mother and but the others as well, who listen too, and what we read on their face then is coming together with what we listen on, what we're listening, and that's really strong. I always find that a silent face comes with a better sound.
Yeah. Okay. And even in what we see of the rape scene, it's all close up on Halima's face rather than, you know, like a wide shot showing it. So again, even when we're there, it's still the sound that really gets us.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Plus, at the same time, I think that the only way to deal with that situation for me as a filmmaker, and being sort of respectful of the dignity of that character, was to be on her face and was to be at all time with her. And so that's why we did this way.
Absolutely. And also the set, I mean, watching it, it feels very, I think, claustrophobic, perhaps, is the word, because, you know, we're so trapped in this apartment and people are going from one room to the other through these corridors. There's so much moving around, but it's in such a small space. I mean, was that what the set was like, that kind of claustrophobic environment, or...?
Well, it was maybe in a sense, but because we were so many in there. But then it was, the sense of this claustrophobic sense is in the picture. I think that the framing helps. It's a difficult question to answer for me. It's more a question of intuition. But I think that the framing is always a little bit tight. And for instance, would I have given it a little bit more space had we seen a little bit more in terms of perspective, in terms of geography or something?
Yeah.
Maybe we wouldn't have that much of this claustrophobic sense. But then that's the way it happens. And then also we have all these walls that are right there, and then and the faces mostly. So it's complicated. I just can't really. I mean, I think it's more intuitive than.
Yeah.
Than
sure.
Also, maybe I'm trying to be a little bit technical, because I'm trying to decode this in a sense. the lenses that we used, the focal length we used, were normal focal length.
Right.
And that are comparable to the eye's view. And so the camera is always strictly being with the people in a way that would be if we were at arm's length of the character, in a sense. So that may give a sense of it.
Okay, yeah.
I'm just...
Yeah, sure. Philip Van Loo, thank you so much for coming
on.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure that was really good.
It sounded good. Yeah, we definitely know how that went.
Yeah.
And it sounded like you had a really good time and a good chat.
I definitely didn't do the interview after we recorded the podcast.
No, not at all.
I can't believe he said that, though.
No, that big thing.
Which changes everything.
I can't believe he's directing Star Wars Episode 9.
I can't believe the whole thing takes place in the Black Lodge.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Scoops here
on the
Curzon Film Podcast. Right. So, Inseriated, what do we make of this?
I thought it was incredibly impressive considering the parameters of the filmmaking.
I think that's a really good way to frame it in terms of like its creation. And the way it's been created for me, by the end of it, I think this is maybe not missold, but you could tell people this is a horror film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's got all the staples of it. You've got people trapped inside.
Yeah.
You've got, like, in another plot, the snipers and the war outside. That could be zombies or a virus. And so because you keep people in, you keep your locations down, you've got a minimum budget, and you're focusing on characters and dialogue and interaction. And for me, yeah, that makes a horror film.
And there are definitely points of comparison with It Comes at Night, which we also discussed on the podcast a few weeks ago. And that is an out-and-out horror film. Mm. So just changing a different aspect of the narrative could completely change the genre. Because everything that they feel, everything that happens, is pretty much what happens to an extent in It Comes at Night. This sort of fear of who do we trust, who's on the outside, who gets to open what door, what doors should stay locked. That's here as well.
Yeah. And I think another thing that we would find a lot of in horror that was absolutely essential to this film is the sound work. And you talk about sound in a film developing a mood and developing an atmosphere, which it does here, but here the sound is plot. This film would not work without that really amazing sound work that's done when people are looking out a window and you just hear a jet or you hear a single bit of rubble crumble or something. The fear that those sounds inject is really impressive.
Yeah, and the sound of the bombs or the missiles, whatever they are, without even seeing one, is even more That's more effective.
Yeah, we barely see anything. What do we see? The one gunshot at the start?
Yeah, and we don't see a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, really impressive sound work. I think that makes the film.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And credit to the actors as well, because obviously they wouldn't have had those things to react to.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they're acting against nothing, and it's really been put together in the edit, the mixture of sound and vision, and it creates such an awful mood, really, that from your first moments in the film, that you translate 1% of what that feeling must be.
Yeah. And there's this whole thing about you said it earlier that they're trapped in a safe space, but it's not safe.
No.
And there are events that transpire in the film that show this really is not a safe space in the slightest. It's as safe as they can possibly get. I suppose the film is saying that in the Syrian war, there is no safe space.
Mm.
You make what you can with what you've got, but you truly can't be safe. And that is a horror film aspect.
Yeah, and something that I think is interesting with the close quarters and the number of characters that are in these close quarters, other than the matriarch figure, I suppose, we're not really sure for a good half hour or so whether there will be a secondary lead of sorts. Everyone is kind of... The camera moves around a lot. It's on this, I imagine, a Steadicam rig, and it just kind of moves in between rooms, seeing snippets of conversations and interactions. And then it is with Halima, the wife of the chap that gets shot at the beginning,
yeah,
who then establishes herself as what, the second lead, and then in the second half of the film, probably the main character almost as well.
Yeah, and I think she has the most to do in terms of, I don't know, we can't judge that, but in terms of acting, she goes through the most. Yeah,
performance is really good. She's, for me, the highlight in it.
Yeah.
She's excellent. Because about halfway through the film, there are these knocks on the door that are set up. Again, yeah, we're looking at creepy knocks on the door, yeah, people looking in, do we trust them, do we not? And there are about three knocks on the door that get ignored, and then ultimately the house gets broken into.
Yeah.
And in this moment, Yazan makes the decision to like take her family, or who we think of as her family, yeah, away, and kind of bolts the kitchen, leaving Halima and the newborn outside, yeah, of the kitchen to face these two men that have broken in. And that's when we see a gun,
yeah,
as well.
We do see a gun, that you're right. And this, yeah, this is kind of the, almost the center point of the film in a way. It's an extended scene of sort of torture and horror. Very difficult to watch. And you mentioned earlier that there are people might be upset by things we're talking about. And this is the scene, I think, that will, yeah, push people over that edge. But it's so well done. And you really don't see much. That's, yeah, the thing, because it's all done really with a close-up on Halima's face, yeah, most of it.
So, because initially the scene is just set out that Halima is trying to protect the people in the, yeah, house, and that she won't give them up to these men. And she's ultimately assaulted by one of them. And yeah, as you say, it's really horrible to watch. And it's horrible as well that the camera is also put in the kitchen, where there is the mother, maybe four children, the grandfather, yeah, and everyone knows what's going on. And everyone, yeah, knows the kind of moral deal that's been struck by, yeah, not opening the door.
And again, it's sound.
Yeah.
It's not done with visuals, this scene as such. It's all done with what's heard through the wall.
Mm.
And the teenage boy who maybe is one of the daughter's boyfriends, or
I think that
cousin?
Was...
cousin? Because he calls her auntie, but I don't know if that was like a term of endearment.
Well, I think there's a few terms, like titles that people have that, yeah, are maybe more friendly titles.
Okay. But yeah, he desperately wants to go out and help her.
Yeah.
And he's told, no, stay here. And yeah, there is that struggle to stay in that room and listen to what's going on without crying, without making a sound.
Yeah. And ultimately, she does save them as well through kind of giving herself up in that instance.
Yeah.
And when you look at her in that moment, you think her performance is already so impressive at just how horrid she must be feeling at this point, and the kind of grief and anguish and anxiety that is already present in the situation on top of what's just happened. And at that point, you almost feel like, just don't say anything. You can't.
Yeah. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Something I find really interesting with the film as a whole, and this is to do with the war itself. This is a war that is still going on. And most quote-unquote war films, or films about a war, so like World War II, like Dunkirk, for example, we know what happens. We know the result of the war. We have hindsight to favour the heroes, essentially. The good guys win. And when we watch, I don't know, Platoon or Apocalypse Now, we know what happens. We know the war eventually finishes. This is one that's still going on now, and we don't know if this situation will ever end for these people, or when it will. And also, we don't know, like, because it's a complicated war. It's a multi-sided war.
That's it. We don't know where anyone is.
These guys that come into their house, we don't know what side they're on, who they are, what if they're soldiers, government officials.
Yeah.
I mean, they're certainly not dressed like soldiers. They're just dressed like normal civilians.
Yeah.
But yeah. So in that way, it's not a normal war film, because we don't have the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah.
We're watching
And
it.
Every bullet and every jet and every bomb, at no point does anyone allude to who could be firing it.
Exactly, yeah. We don't, this family seemingly don't have a stake in this war. it's not like they're a, you know, they're an invaded country that are waiting for someone to come and save them or anything like that. Yeah. It seems kind of hopeless for them.
Yeah, that's it. And something that's admirable in it is the way that they just, people try to try and get on as well. There's a really lovely line where Hiam Abbas's character says, "Now some more dusting, then lunch."
Yeah.
I think that's it. Like, that's what you're getting through things. That's it. You're surviving by giving yourself the thing to look forward to is lunch. And then the scene when they do have lunch for a few seconds before someone makes scene. I think this is a moment of peace.
Yeah. Don't they laugh or something about something as well?
Mm.
Yeah. And there's also kind of little dramas within this surrounding conflict, like when the boy like sticks a pin in his grandfather's ass.
Yeah.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he chases him around the house. So there's just little moments like that that kind of show you that this is essentially what we think of as like a sort of, you know, low budget family drama.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And then you suddenly, you're in another film. You're in like The Squid and the Whale for seconds. And then the sound comes in again and you remember everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And I think the actual set decoration of the home is really interesting, because when we look at in a lot of films about war, a home of that is at the center of a bombed area will traditionally not be a kind of middle class home that is furnished with a library sized bookshelf
and a maid
a big table and there's, I think that was actually really interesting way of presenting war affecting a lot of people as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And not that I liked the film, but I think the story in The Kite Runner similarly looks at someone who is really quite wealthy and just how war in this respect, I know a lot of the time this is not the case and it will predominantly affect people in a different class, but this is just sweeping over everyone.
Everything, yeah, everyone in its path. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The film that it reminded me of a lot was Under the Shadow from last year.
Right.
So obviously they're totally different wars. I mean, Under the Shadow is set in Tehran during the Iraq-Iran war, but they're both about essentially women in charge of a family while war surrounds them. And in Under the Shadow, she's the last one in this apartment block, like in Infuriated. Mm. And Under the Shadow has this kind of supernatural plot going on as well. But in both of them, they're kind of surrounded by a conflict that all they want to do is survive with their family.
Mm.
And they refuse to leave their homes because they think they shouldn't have to. And that's interesting that these two films have come out at the same time. Well, within, you know, close proximity to each other.
Yeah, yeah. Right, so we should probably wrap it up there. But if you do want to watch Infuriated and you can't make it to a cinema, do not fret.
Because
if you only have an internet connection, you can watch it on Curzon Home Cinema as well. So it's exclusively on Curzon Home Cinema from today, or depending on when you're listening to this, it'll be on there now. And you can check that out if you cannot make it to the cinema. But if you can make it to the cinema, I think that would be great, again, for the sound work.
Yeah,
That immersion within this home, I think, would be really worth checking out too. And as well as Infuriated, if you go on to Curzon Home Cinema now and you are also a Curzon member, if you log in to the service, you can now access Curzon 12, which is a new service for Curzon members, which gives you access to 12 free films. They're already on there. So it's for 400 Blows, Fish Tank, The Kid with a Bike, Rien Ne Va Plus, Michael H. Profession Director, Alps, I, Anna, Wreckers, The Lonely Wife, First Position, Modern Times, and Mid-August Lunch are all on there, and they are now all free. So once you've watched Infuriated, you can check all of those out as well.
Easy.
Lovely stuff. Right, until next time, it's goodbye from Sam.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.